That is our standard song. That means that people showed up late. When that song plays, that's like the one song that's just constantly playing on the main course.
That's right. And this is the main course with Patrick Martins and...
You're Katie Kiefer.
That's right. We have a great show today. We have, we hope, Alice Waters lined up for our first segment.
Alice Waters. That's founder right. One of the founders of the organic movement. It's actually very unusual that such a large movement like that can so be traced officially almost to one kind of spot.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, most people are like, well, it wasn't. I mean, there's still obviously some people say it's Jeremiah Tower. Other people say it's that guy who does the organic wines. I forget his name. What was it?
No clue.
Anyway,
no,
there are a few people, but I mean, it's pretty much,
that Alice Waters has been the main spokesperson and one of the biggest driving forces, I think, behind the whole organic movement. That's for sure. Thank you, Alice.
Yeah. No, she's pretty amazing. She actually came to Roberta's the other day and loved it.
I'm sure she did. Well, she's funded the fabulous garden upstairs.
Yeah, she was one of the sponsors of the sustainable organic garden upstairs. And she actually came and took all these young, you know, hubris-filled gardeners. And they were like, this is our tomato plant area. She's like, you shouldn't plant the big tomatoes. You work too long. You only get one tomato and you eat it. And you're like, it's over. Whereas the little tomatoes,
yes,
you know, they come faster.
Extremely well, yeah.
And you can get them all the time kind of thing. So.
Well, live and learn. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you plant the garden one year, you find those things out, and the next year you plant it better.
She's actually coming on. She was given an honorary doctorate at Princeton.
Yes, she was.
And now she's getting another doctorate. She organizes her Lifetime Achievement Awards into single, you know, trips.
That's right. Very sensible.
And then,
so you get them all the time like that. You know, you can't have your whole life directed by your Lifetime Achievement Awards.
Exactly. I owe Alice a lot. When I was trying to run Slow Food, the Northern California groups were like, who is this kid? Who is New York? We're our own. We are Slow Food. You know, even though they weren't. They didn't do anything outside their chapters. But they were like, we're not. And so Alice, like, kept them at bay. Like, she was like, they wanted to secede. I mean, it was like Civil War.
Really?
Like Jefferson.
Hilarious.
That was his name, Jefferson, the guy that seceded from the Union?
Jefferson Davis.
Jefferson Davis, yeah. Davis, I mean.
Yeah.
So who else is on?
So we also have Shanna Pacifico from Back 40 Restaurant. We're excited to have her on the air with us today. She's going to be telling us about how she sources for her restaurant and some of the really interesting things on her menu.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a fascinating menu that's full of old time and new time type dishes. I was really, really blown away by it.
I want to ask her, I hear she sources all of her fish from the Pacifico, none from the Atlantico. I don't know if that's... But that's pretty cool. So I hear we have Alice on the line. Alice, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, my God. Tell us exactly where you are. Are you at a gas station or something?
No, actually, we pulled off the road. We're on our way up the east side of the Hudson River.
Oh.
And we pulled into a sort of rest zone, and it's just covered with wild honeysuckle. And I'm outside talking to you from this place.
And who's your driver today?
And my driver today is Ham Fish.
Hamilton Fish. Sure.
The head of the Nation Foundation. And he's taking me up the Hudson River.
Ham Fish was once a publisher. I worked with him.
Yes, he is a publisher.
Absolutely, because he published a book that I publicized by Ved Mehta many years ago.
That's Katie Kiefer, Alice. She's the co-host.
Hello.
Alice. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making the stop and taking the time with us.
So, Alice, tell us what brings you to the East Coast? It sounds like there's a few things. I mean, some doctorates, some movies. Tell us about your trip here.
Well, I guess the main reason that I came was I was receiving an honorary degree from Princeton.
Wow.
Congratulations.
That happened last Tuesday, and it felt like a real opening for what will happen in terms of sort of ecology and gastronomy at that university. It was a very beautiful moment in time.
And do you feel the people at Princeton get it?
I'm headed down to Washington after this weekend, and hope to see the garden on the White House lawn, and hope to go to Mount Vernon and Monticello and gather with friends and in the farmers market down there in Washington.
Now, Alice, do the people at Princeton get it? I mean, do they produce good food?
Is Patrick, there... can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me? Alice.
Patrick?
Alice! Can you hear me, Alice?
Stop moving.
Patrick. Yes, Alice.
I lost you. Can I lost you there.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. I don't know where I left off, though.
I heard everything. Everyone could hear everything. So tell me, do the people at Princeton get it? Is there potential for them to make great food there?
Well, they're very enthusiastic, and they have talked about the progress that they've made in the last couple of years in buying food from local purveyors, and have said that as much as 50% of the food served to students comes from farms nearby. So that, to me, was a revelation. I think it's so hard to do that at a big institution unless the whole, really administration is behind you and the president is in support. Mm.
And that's happening at Princeton. So
that is, in fact, what's happening.
Mm-hmm, that's fabulous. There are, I know, other universities that are also getting very serious about providing better food for the students. In fact, very much student-run initiatives to source locally. I know there's a university in upstate New York. I'm kind of blanking on the name. It might even be Cornell because of the hospitality school there. But they are also organizing big student sort of cooperatives in terms of bringing in local produce. And they converted a canning factory, I think, up there. Huh.
Now, Alice, let me ask you, when a school changes, how much of that is the students and how much of that is the top down? Like when you did the Yale Sustainable Food Project, did you have to build a student body reaction to the bad food, or does it happen through
fortunately, there was a very strong environmental group that was in lobbying to change the food in the residential colleges. But it really has to do with how much money the university is going to dedicate to that sort of really change, because just to bring the existing food, which is all subsidized food, up to real food is a certain amount of money. But
that's right.
To really make it food that comes from sustainable local producers, then that's another amount of money. And that's a step that is very difficult to take for big institutions that have been having a budget that is very low.
Absolutely.
And so there's not a way to do this unless the students are organized, the parents of the students, the alums, everyone comes together and says, this is something we need to have happen. This is how we want our children to be fed, because we know that this is what they need to live on this planet in the future. They need to,
Absolutely.
Know how to take care
of the children
land.
Need to be educated about food, because there really isn't a vehicle for that education currently in school systems. Now, just to switch gears quickly, Alice, one of the things that I'm sure you're excited about is the opening of Food Inc., which will be coming up in, I guess, a couple of days, right? I think June 12th is the official opening.
June 12th is the official date, and I hope that everyone has an opportunity to see it. What we don't know about our food system in this country, and it was a revelation to me, and I know a lot about it.
Yeah.
So it's going to be shocking to many people, and it's why we have to sort of be ready to bring people an alternative way of eating, and that's what I'm working on in the public school system, and nothing short of that, I think, is really going to make the change in what's going on.
To just lead on from that thought, I'm sure you saw Amanda Hesser's editorial a week or so ago about sort of chiding Michelle Obama for, you know, planting the garden but not really being a cook. And it's always it's always been my fear that, you know, we can all support sustainable agriculture and local agriculture, but if people don't actually know how to cook, then it's kind of irrelevant. And I've heard other, you know, Dan Barber made the same point at a panel that I attended a few weeks ago, and I do think that's an important part of this puzzle. How are we going to move that part of this puzzle into the, you know, to lock into the rest of the movement here? Because people do not spend time in the kitchen.
Just to add to that, I mean, how could you chide Michelle Obama, first of all? But no, but it does speak to eco-gastronomy. You know, you have the eco, but what about the gastronomy?
Well, I just think I have my own stimulus plan. I would go into the public schools. I would put all my money there. I would feed every single child from preschool through high school for free. They wouldn't pay. It would be part of their education. And every school would have a criteria for the buying of sustainably raised local food, a priority there, a criteria for the buying. And then I would weave food into every course. Instead of, you know, in math, they're counting heritage beans instead of buttons. Mm-hmm, you know, they're doing the math of measuring garden beds. They're doing the geography of pounding spices in India when they're studying that country in the classroom. I would weave this together and have an interactive experience for all children in the kitchen and the garden and the cafeteria, so that when they grow up, they know how to cook, they know how to take care of the land, they know how to have a conversation at the table. And I don't want to miss any child. So it's so important that we go to the public school system where we have the potential to touch children early enough before they're in the habits and the really addiction of
junk food. Absolutely.
World.
Well, yeah. Alice, we have a sound effect for you. Did you hear that?
Patrick, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
No.
All right. Well, Alice, thank you so much for being on. You are a cougar. You're amazing. You're an inspiration.
Totally inspiring.
I'm just uncompromising about this. I find that the feeding of children is the most important thing that we can do as a society. We must take care of them in the very best possible way.
You are the mother of all children.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alice.
Thank you, Alice.
I love you. I am.
Safe travels.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wow, that was nice.
That was great.
That was Alice's first time on.
First of many, I'm sure.
She just came to Roberta's and she absolutely loved it. So I'm sure she will be back. She was sorry she couldn't make it live. But I guess on that note, we should take a break and come back with Shauna Pacifico.
Absolutely.
Here we are back on the main course.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
I'm Patrick Martins.
And today we have Shauna Pacifico with us from the Back 40 Acres.
What an honor. That's one of my favorite. I mean, I really do not drop this lightly. I have four or five restaurants that I really, really, really love. It is so comfortable there. And the food, you know, is so solid. And I'm a big fan of Back 40. It kind of feels like you're not in New York, you know, like you're more in Berkeley or something. But I'm a big fan, and Shauna also has one of my favorite dishes in New York, the jowl nugget, which we will be talking about at length.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing about jowl nuggets. Like, how did you come up with
that? Hey, Shauna, by the way, welcome. You have to bring the mic closer.
Hello.
Yeah, we can hear you.
I can't hear myself. Oh, you can hear me. Okay, good.
Maybe your headphones aren't working.
Are they working?
I can hear you guys.
Okay.
Okay, right, good.
Then they're working.
Hi.
Hey, Shauna.
Hello.
So, Shauna, tell us about Back 40. How long have you been there?
I've been there since the opening.
Oh, really? And
before
so how
the
long
opening.
Is that?
We've been open for about a year and a half.
Uh-huh. And you were the first chef, so this was your concept, was the concept behind this menu, obviously.
No, it's Peter Hoffman's concept.
Oh, Peter Hoffman. Okay, gotcha.
And he's the chef owner. Mm-hmm. I'm just the person that's there every day.
You just execute the menu.
I come up with the menu and execute it, but the whole original concept was his. And
so how does that work? I mean, how what are the real nitty-gritty of how that works? I mean, he tells you more or less, I want you to source from here, you can do the menu, or
In the beginning it was more this is what we do. I mean, I already knew that because I worked for Peter a few years ago when I first got out of culinary school, so I kind
at
of
Savoy
at Savoy. Mm-hmm. So I already knew his concept and how he wanted things to be done, and through that we've evolved to what we are now with the menu that it is now.
So tell us about the menu. Give listeners a sense of what is the philosophy behind this menu, and what are you sort of hoping to show people? And, you know, all about the seasonality of it. You know,
yeah, what makes it different?
What makes it so
special?
There's so
many restaurants in New
York.
Well,
I think what makes it different is that it's so accessible to a lot of people, because it's very it's a very inexpensive restaurant to eat at. Mm-hmm. And I think it's
what's the average price?
Average price, I would say, is probably about $30 for a person to come eat there.
Uh-huh.
With a drink.
Yeah,
With a drink, maybe cool. A nap. And, you know, we have an $11 burger. Mm-hmm. Then we'll have a few other things that are around. There's really nothing on the menu over $20, $21.
Mm-hmm. That seems reasonable.
Unless we get something that is obviously needs to be a little bit more. But generally.
Note for the future, I want to ask about the burger, too. So we're going to talk about jowl nuggets and burgers.
Yeah. And let's also talk
my
about
my favorite topic.
Fish,
too.
Right.
Yeah, fish. Since we were joking where you source your fish from.
Well, tell us a little bit about, before we get to, we'll do nuggets, burgers, fish.
Okay.
But where did you come from originally? I mean, was Savoy your first gig out of culinary school?
Savoy was my first gig out of culinary school. I happened to just stumble upon it. I went to the school at the French Culinary Institute.
Okay, Dorothy Cowan Hamilton.
Yes, which was a good education.
She's so powerful. That's
I don't know what that meant, but like,
she's an intense lady.
She is an intense lady. I did try to ask her a few questions once. She definitely was very intense.
I love Dorothy to death. She gave us our first slow food office. It was in my apartment for a number of years. But, I mean, she's just so high-powered. I mean, with the September 11th, like, the city was wooing her to move the entire institute downtown. I mean, she's a big, powerful, so that's why. That's what that sound effect meant.
Okay, good. I'm glad you had that clarification for us, Patrick. So go on, Shauna, tell us more.
Yeah, so I went to school at the French Culinary Institute, and I stumbled upon Savoy through somebody that says, I heard this restaurant's hiring. At the time, I wasn't very familiar with sustainable, local, green market.
This was how many years ago? Like 3 years ago?
No, this is 9 years ago.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yeah. You look so youthful.
Thanks.
Sorry about
coming
that.
Up on the 30th.
But like 9 years ago, local, sustainable, locavore wasn't really happening. Let's
absolutely
face it.
Absolutely not.
So, it wasn't happening.
You know,
but
the word artisanal is still not accepted on most spell checks.
Yeah, right.
Artisanally.
I would say it wasn't happening because it wasn't as trendy as it is now.
Totally.
But Peter Hoffman's restaurant Savoy has been there for almost 20 years.
He was like the original biker to the farmer's market almost.
Him, Dan Barb, you know, they all started around, you know, the same time. So I happened to stumble across Savoy and started off working there, shaking in my boots, really afraid of what am I doing here? This makes no sense. I mean, I didn't even know what coriander was.
Okay.
And I come from a family of of my mother was a home chef. You know, my family's from Brazil, and
Family's from Brazil.
Yes, I'm Brazilian.
My family's from Brazil.
Oh, really?
Falo português.
Falo português.
Eu também.
Eu também. Okay.
Okay.
So,
very
good. Continue. Right.
Now that we've exhausted our
Quit
Portuguese.
Showing off.
Yeah. I grew up in Florida, and so when I moved to New York, it was just kind of like a culture shock in that sense of being able to find just really good food anywhere and not have to be a chain restaurant or fast food place or just somewhere that just served bad food. So Savoy, I kind of stumbled upon, and from there my eyes were opened. And ever since then, Peter's been a mentor and a teacher, a really
that's
good
great.
One.
Well, that's what a good chef is supposed to do.
Yeah,
absolutely.
They're not supposed to terrorize you. They're supposed to push you along so that you can open your own restaurant.
She's the furthest
someday.
Away from being a terrorist that I've ever known.
I also like Peter that he stuck with one restaurant for a really long time, and then he opened one other restaurant, which is almost the way Alice did it. She didn't just, and
she
I also
franchise
respect,
her name. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I think that's pretty cool. And it means that it shows the quality shows, that. Now, how much time does he spend there?
He spends, I'd probably say, equal amount of time at both places. He's more of trying to be the restaurateur, in my opinion, and run two successful businesses, but still have input on as much as possible.
Got it. Well, we are going to come to our first break now, and then I guess we should come back and talk some details like burgers and
what
nuggets.
What are you making, Chow?
Absolutely.
We want to hear all about the Pacifico Ocean.
But in the meantime,
how you get the food over. I thought you guys
were
local.
You're bringing me back to my childhood. That's like what they used to call me when I was a kid.
I'm sorry to bring this up. This has nothing to do with the main course, but there was this one scene in The Jeffersons, which I always loved. It was a spinoff of All in the Family, and there was a picture of the ocean right over their telephone, which is where a lot of the action took place, because I was on the phone. And George Jefferson was like, the beauty of this painting is that it could be the Atlantic or the Pacific. So that was so ridiculous. I was like 6 years old, but I always remembered it. Anyway, we'll take a break and come back with Shauna Pacifico from Back 40.
We're back. It's Heritage Radio Network. This is The Main Course with
Patrick Martins.
And Katie Kiefer. And we have Shauna Pacifico with us from Back 40 Restaurant. We are proud to be sponsored by TechServe today.
Best Macintosh store in the world.
Absolutely. So, Shauna, we were talking with you earlier about some of the great things that are on the Back 40 menu, including jowl nuggets and your amazing $11 burger and fish. So let's hear a little bit about the burgers, first of all, because there's so much play. I mean, there's my teacher from the New School has just published a book about burgers. There was George Toad who did the film about burgers. It's like burgers are really, I don't know, they're just hot right now.
They're really cool.
What cuts go into your burger?
Is it
always the same?
No, it changes because we get a half steer in every week. Sometimes more than a half steer, depending on if the burger just got in the New York Times, which it did recently, and that was insane. It was like burgers flying out the window. But we do. We get a half steer in, and we share some of that meat with Savoy, our other restaurant, mm-hmm. who takes the prime cuts and who is a little bit more higher end.
How do you divide it? I mean, give us some of the
they
principal
take the
cuts.
Really nice, delicious, expensive cuts.
So ribeye, they take the porterhouse,
the tenderloin. The ribeye, all that stuff.
The middle meats.
The middle meats. And then we...
You get love with the chuck.
You get the chuck roll and the
sirloin. But you know what? I've fallen in love with some of those shoulder cut steaks that
they
put
so
on the menu.
Better.
They're just... Yeah. I mean... They are a little bit tougher, but there's just so much flavor in them, and they're so versatile that you can do many things with.
It's also the cut that all humankind grew up with, 90% more than the middle meats, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, you went out to a steakhouse to get something like a strip or a porterhouse. Yeah. Nobody had that in their own home, at least nobody I knew.
No.
How do you keep consistent burger if you keep using different cuts?
Well, it's... That's a little bit harder to answer. I would say that the burger is consistent. I think it's more about what we really do is I just cut it all up. We just cut it up and grind it ourselves. So it's basically getting the right mix of everything with the right amount of fat. And it tends to be pretty generally consistent.
And you do it by taste each time? You're like, it's ready?
You know what? After you break down a few cows, you know how to do it. You just look at it and you're like, okay, we got it.
Well, and also there are consistently pieces that are not suitable for anything but grinding up.
Exactly.
So you know which ones those are.
Exactly.
I mean, when I worked in a butcher shop, we did that also.
Worked at a butcher shop?
For 5 years. I'm a butcher. You didn't know that?
Well, that's a topic for another show. That's
one of my favorite things.
That was the first thing I learned when I started cooking professionally was glove boning ducks, actually. We had to do 500 of them. I mean, that's another story. But anyway.
Glove boning ducks. Is that allowed? Can we say that on the air?
I don't even know what that is, but that sounds really interesting.
Oh, it's so cool. For making galantine.
Ah, yes, I get
it. You do know what it is.
And do you have a bandsaw?
We don't. We don't really. The steer does come in three different parts or four different parts.
So you get the primal
cuts. The shoulder and the leg and all that stuff. We just kind of go at it and we grind it ourselves and mix it up ourselves. And I do everything. I get heart, I get tail, I get tongue.
Do you serve the heart? Are you able to sell that on the menu?
Savoy has been serving it. I just started experimenting with it. I'm going to try to see if we can get our customers to buy it.
You want
to
see if it takes off?
I think if you prepare anything well and season it well and you can get somebody to try it, it'll take off.
Okay, next. What was the next? I want to go to
Jowl Nuggets.
Jowl Nuggets next.
Oh, your favorite. Every time Patrick comes into Back 40, he orders like five of those.
I mean, literally. Well, first of all, the sauce is a very medieval sauce. It's like a sweet and sour sauce.
It's basically just a jalapeno jam. Just jalapeno cooked with sugar and vinegar and a little pectin.
Hot and
it's sweet. You know, it's definitely I felt like when you were eating the pork chops, because they are so unctuous and fatty and
rich
that you needed something spicy and and tangy to cut that down, and that's why the portion size is really small, because I don't think most people should eat more than three or four pieces of that it's good, but it's...
They might suffer from unctuousitis or something.
Unctuousitis.
Well, it's like eating too much Wagyu beef. I mean, you're not supposed to eat a huge, big, fat steak of Wagyu. You're supposed to have a few slices of it.
Yeah, it's definitely about portion control on that. And the price tag definitely goes with it. You get, a little bit for $4. And and then it's just one or two bites, and it's a good way to start a meal.
Who conceived the jowl nugget? It's so unusual. It's always been my favorite part of the pig, although I didn't know it for years.
I did.
Really?
Yes.
You run.
What do you do?
So you buy whole pigs as well as whole cow?
No,
cow?
I actually buy the pork jowl from Heritage, from Patrick.
12 pieces fatty jowl, bacon subs.
I was originally doing some... That's exactly
He's got
what
your
it is.
Menu, your order,
And they
memorized.
Still call me and harass me every week what my order is going to be.
Harass.
Basically, I was doing some dishes with guanciale because I love guanciale, which you cure and slightly dry out the pork jowl. And then I had one day a lot of extra pork jowl because I wasn't paying attention to how much we were actually using. And I was like, what am I going to do with this? And then I ended up braising it in stout beer and some other stuff. And then we pressed it. And then I was like looking at it. And then I was like, what if we just bread it and fry it? And I cut it in all different shapes and sizes. And then it evolved into the pork jowl nugget. Cheeky McNuggets was a name that was going.
Oh, I love
for.
That. Oh, that's
but
great.
We didn't think we could put that on the menu.
That's excellent.
Now, can you use all the jowl as a skin off, maybe 2-2.5 pound piece? Can you use all the parts of it for the nugget?
I use most of it. We just trim it a little bit to try to make it look into a little cube. But but the trim usually goes into yummy pasta for family meal.
Very, very fascinating. If you have not been to the jowl nugget, and now we move towards the sea.
Thank
you. Don't worry. There's only 4 more sound effects on this board. We're almost done. But Katie,
try to work them all in.
You were adamant to ask Shauna some fish questions.
Well, I wanted to ask you a fish question because it's come up on a lot of blogs and I think maybe even in the news. I never remember where I get my information. But apparently there's a whole group of people who are pressuring Nobu to stop serving bluefin tuna. And I wondered, you know, like, first of all, what your attitude was about that, and also where you guys get your fish, since it is, I mean, it is becoming more and more of a sensitive subject, you know, where people buy their fish from, where the fish is being sourced from, what countries are selling it, and what their policies are towards fish. So,
well, if we keep going the way we're going, we're practically going to eat all the fish in the Atlantic Ocean.
I know,
absolutely. So,
listen, my mother used to do oceanography, you know, a newsletter for the University of Rhode Island years ago, and in 25 years ago, Georges Bank was already, like, overfished, and they were losing population, and you know, it was the biggest breeding ground in the Northeast, I think, for fish. So it's got to be a lot worse now because nobody has really done anything major to stop that.
Well, I'd say for us at Back 40, it's probably one of the most challenging things is to find sustainable fish. And it's hard. You can't always do local when it comes to fish, especially since we are on the Atlantic and now a lot of things are in danger there. And it's also because of our price point, we want to make our menu accessible to a lot of people that it's hard to, I can't just put salmon on the menu because I would have to charge $30 for it, for the kind of salmon that we want to serve.
Right.
So that definitely makes it a challenge. And we have, right now I'm getting some fish. I'm getting some white Louisiana shrimp from a company called Sea to Table. They do Tobago Wild, Alaska Wild, and they basically overnight the fish and it comes straight from the farmer. Nothing's ever frozen. We were doing some trout from Edenbrook, which is up in the Catskills. And it's basically just really trying to think outside of the box.
Farm-raised, does that mean?
It's farm-raised, but it's definitely...
sustainable.
It's sustainable, yeah.
Some things are bad farm-raised.
Some things are
bad, okay.
But catfish is actually still pretty good farm-raised.
Because all they do is just sit at the bottom
and soak
stuff
they're not
up.
Really, you know, they're not really building a farm for them. They've already are there in that sense. And then my favorite fish that we get, which we do get pretty much local, is the porgy. We do a whole grilled porgy, and a lot of people don't know about
it. Where do they come from?
Porgy, it's
locally.
The best.
It's really,
I always think of that as a southern fish.
Did you guys not get that? Porgy, it's the best?
Oh, sorry. I was busy thinking about where it came from.
It's fished out in Montauk, out in Long Island Sound.
Oh,
it's definitely a local. It's not a big commercial fish because they can't get a lot of money for it. It's considered the, you know, the poor man's fish, but I'm telling you, it's really delicious.
I just got back from Kansas City and they were feeding us crappie, which is like the poor man's lake fish. But it's interesting, the poor man fishes are the best. My ex-father-in-law was an anchovy producer, you know, and he always maintained that those little black fish, you know, little guys were always the best ones, you know, the
tastiest.
Well,
it's like being a butcher, you know, you always save the best part for you, which is probably the part you can't sell, but it's the most delicious and flavorful, and there's not a ton of it.
Don't you see a big change in consumers, though? I mean, since you're a restaurant chef, don't you see, like, a big change in people's willingness to try new things? I mean, the idea that you could sell a jowl nugget, you know, 10 years ago, never.
That's where the concept of Back 40 has come from and has evolved, too, in a sense that there is such a change. It's so accessible now. It's not... you know, such a far away reach to buy, you know, things locally, and it's just becoming more supported, and we're supporting more farmers, and it's making it easier.
Absolutely.
And they're willing to try things. I've done some pretty funny things, which people are like, oh, you're not going to sell that. And I sold it, and the Jow Nuggets was one of them.
It's amazing.
And, you know, I get, you know, skinny little model girls eating the Jow Nuggets, and they're like, this is so delicious. I'm like,
Yeah, you need more of those, sweetie. Here, have some more, and then you'll look like a human.
All right. So, I'm like the only guy in this whole
That's
studio.
Right. It's a real estrogen fest.
Where are you? Well, this show is produced by Heather Hyman and engineered by Nat Wiener. And Shauna, I mean, I hope you understand, really take this to heart. We want you to come on many times. You don't have to only come on like once a year. Hopefully you can come on a few weeks and give us menu changes and all that.
Absolutely. I'd
love
to.
Sit in with me
and
Katie.
Talk more about what you're doing at Back 40. And also, I want to talk more with restaurant chefs like you about what I asked Alice Waters, which was, how do we make the average consumer get more interested in cooking?
That's definitely one of my biggest concerns. And I think it's you start with us. You start with cooking and bringing it out. You know, I wish it would go a little bit faster to reach the middle America, because my family's from there and they don't get it.
From where?
From Florida.
It always starts with the chefs. They are starting it. I mean, I can see it with Heritage Foods. I mean, the chefs, it is a trickle-down thing.
It really is.
I don't believe that in politics, but I do believe that with food. So you are leading the way, and you've done something unique with the Jowl Nugget, but also with everything at Back 40. So
yeah, it's a great
thanks,
venue.
Shauna, for getting out here with no L train.
No, yeah, that was fun.
It was an adventure in Bushwick.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back with Chris Parrachini, who's going to talk about gelato.
Yay.
Katie.
Yeah, right.
This is a professional. We're trying to be professional here, damn it.
This is a professional outfit. Yes. Well, this is Heritage Radio Network, and we are in the last segment of the main course.
Two segments. We have two segments with one of my favorite people. This is, by the way, sponsored by TechServe, number one Mac store in the universe.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we're here at Roberta's Restaurant with proprietor
Chris Parrachini.
Hello.
You are awfully tan, Chris. Are you coming from some foreign nation or something?
Yeah, I just spent 3 weeks and 2 weeks in Italy and 1 week in the Canary Islands, in Lanzarote.
In the Canary Islands?
Yeah.
Now that's romantic. Now, weren't the Canary Islands once a Portuguese colony, or is that just the Azores?
I think just the Azores. I think it was it was a Spanish colony, and it's still part of the Spanish sovereign, whatever.
I did not realize that.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And what drew you to the Canary Islands?
Besides vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it was. Yeah.
You took a vacation and you own a restaurant? I thought that was against the rules.
It had been a few years.
I was cracking up. I needed to go. One of our partners is an Italian guy by the name of Mauro, and his brother is a chef in Lanzarote at definitely the finest restaurant on the island.
What's the restaurant's name? Or what's his brother's name?
His brother's name is Paolo Soju. And the restaurant's name is...
you would ask that, Patrick.
You would, and
sorry.
Of course I would forget it. I can't, I don't know.
Yeah, it's in the Canary Islands, folks. You know, how many restaurants...
That's where the finest restaurant is.
Exactly.
If you'll get there.
Right.
It's in the Princess Aiza Hotel.
What's happening in the Canary Islands? I mean, are they becoming more and more of a tourist destination for the Spaniards? So the food is primarily Spanish in style? Is that the...
No, it's pretty international. They're definitely becoming a big-time European tourist destination. Mm-hmm. That extends far beyond Spaniards at this point. There
cool.
A lot of Germans, British, some Italians.
Where is it exactly?
It's basically due west from the part of Morocco that kind of makes the turn, or the corner of North Africa. Mm. It's out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. They're volcanic islands. They were formed not that long ago. Their last major eruption was like 100 and some odd years ago, and the volcano on Lanzarote erupted for 8 days straight.
Ooh,
so you drive through the island, and it only takes you about an hour to cross it by car, and you drive through these amazing lava fields that are pretty freshly formed, and it literally looks like the surface of the moon.
Wow.
And it feels like the surface of the moon because you're out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and the water's relatively cold, the wind blows all day long, and very few things can live on the island, so it seems. Mm. And we saw some cool farms there. They basically dig giant beds into the lava rock and they plant all their crops below the surface of the ground because the wind is so ferocious.
It would just blow them right flat.
Exactly.
Huh. Yeah.
And they also...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there are some really cool wine producers there, too. A couple of the larger vineyards have pretty extensive, vineyards. And they build these lava rock walls and grow the grapes only about 2 feet high behind the wall to keep them shielded from the wind.
Amazing.
So they're making do with what they got. And it's also cool. I mean, if you like talking about terroir... I've never tasted terroir like this before. It's so strong, pungent, like there's a minerality.
I was going to say, it must be very minerally because of the volcanic soil.
So minerally.
Like in the tomatoes or in the everything. Really. That's
everything.
Amazing.
Yeah, and like, so to eat like lettuce, you know, lettuces or any kind of greens, it really is, the first taste that hits your mouth is mineral. And
you're just like, is that always a good thing? I don't know.
No. I mean, for my taste, no.
Yeah, right? Tomato, I don't want to taste a mineral. I want to taste something else. Fruit.
The tomatoes I thought were decent. The lettuces I was having a really hard time with. Mm-hmm. There was nothing sweet about them. It was kind of like chewing rocks. But
yikes.
Ooh,
and,
yummy.
Do they have, I mean, they probably can't import much stuff. So, I mean, do they try to be self-sufficient? Are there livestock being raised there and stuff? Or do they just eat fish?
Pigs and goats.
Okay.
Actually, surprisingly enough, they don't eat very much fish. They eat some octopus and some squid. And there's a fish around called La Vecchia, the old timer, mm-hmm. whatever. And they eat that, and they don't eat much else. And you're like, you guys are on an island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
And your diet is about 3% fish. Actually, they do eat, there are these things called lapas, too. They're sort of a mix between a clam and abalone, and they only live there on the Canary Islands, and I ate those. They were pretty fantastic.
I have to say, I'm always amazed at Jamestown, I think, was a settlement in America,
in Virginia,
and
yeah.
they all died of starvation, and yet they were at the
on
foot
the coast.
Of the Atlantic Ocean.
The foot of the Chesapeake Bay,
what's
practically,
going on?
Right?
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Freaking
yeah.
fishing rod, and that's all you need, but that's interesting, and the food is essentially good, like, but you were also throughout Italy, right? I mean, you didn't just visit there. I mean, was the food good in the Canary Islands, and...
Yeah, the local fare was really good. The best goat cheese I've ever had in my life was from there. Hmm. And I think I don't think it's from what the goats are eating. I know that I talked to some producers there, and the production technique is still the original one from probably how all goat cheese was made prior to 100 or 150 years ago, which, basically works something like this. They take, a young goat, about 10 days old. They take it right from the mother's teat, and they slaughter it immediately. They immediately butcher it. They pull the stomach out, still filled with the mom's milk, and they hang the stomach in the sun.
Wow.
And they draw the culture for the cheese from...
Oh, that's the rennet.
God. Yeah, right.
Yeah, they don't use commercial rennet. They still use organic rennet.
Yes.
Which this country, I don't think... Hardly anyone, even in
Europe. Is it allowed?
Even in Europe, it's. I don't think they got DOP status, so they're doing it. But no, generally speaking, it's not allowed. But to taste it, it was by far the most complex goat cheese I've ever tasted. And after eating it, I don't know if I want to eat any other goat cheese.
Yeah.
But is it a fresh or is it a
long ripened cheese? Is it they let both. It get hard and oh they have both.
Okay. They'll take some of the production and put it aside for fresh cheese, and then they'll take some and put it aside for 3 months aged, 6 months, 9 months, whatever. They'll wash it in a bunch of different stuff, pimentón, some kind of like citrus bath on one of the other aged ones I had, and they were totally amazing. So they do a lot of different stuff with basically the same raw ingredients.
Right. Do they ever wrap them? I mean, I remember when I was a teenager, I lived in France for a year in 1970, and the cheese that really turned me on to the world of cheese in general, besides Liederkranz in America, I admit it, was a goat cheese that it came from Poitou, and it was in that log form, and it was wrapped in grasses. I've never seen that cheese again in France. I've been back many times since then. But it picked up the flavors of the grasses, and I would imagine, and I know there are other cheeses they wrap in salt grass and in this and that and the other kind of leaf, like Banon, I think, is wrapped in some kind of leaf. And do they do that? Are they using those kinds of techniques? Because that seemed like so old school and cool to me when I was a kid.
They
still does.
They may be. I saw enough cheese wrapped in enough different stuff. None of them grass that I would venture to guess that they wrap them in all kinds of stuff depending on where you are. Which reminds me, can I speak about Castamagno real quick?
Yes. No, but you have a whole other segment.
You have another segment because you have to talk about gelato.
You have another 7 minutes after this. But what I like about wrapping it in grass is you can smoke it too.
Yeah. Only on the Heritage Radio Network.
Yes, only on the Heritage Radio Network. God, I love the sound effect board. I hear Nat also gave me a whole other.
Oh, that's sweet.
That's
nice.
Whoa.
That's very evocative.
That's the goat cheese sound right there.
You go.
That's on your
palate.
That's
the grassy palate. One. Yeah.
Anyway, we will be right back with Chris Paracchini, and we're going to talk other things about it. He said something very interesting. He once told me, Carlo Petrini said, bread culture is horrible in Italy. And I was like, really? He's like, we make the worst bread in Europe right now.
Oh,
and Chris said something that reminded me of that. So maybe when we come back, we'll talk about that.
Pick it up there. That's great. Thanks, Chris.
Late at night, when you're all alone, and the wrongs you've done me, I'll come home. Some will be late at night when you're half asleep and you pray the Lord your soul to keep. Won't always be nice dreams, though some will be. You'll dream of me.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by our friends at TechServe. www.techserve.com.
That is the butteriest voice I've ever heard.
Yeah, we know.
Sounds really good, baby.
Yeah. Chris, tell us
TechServe.
More. His voice is like gelato. So you flew into... Rome? Oh, no, you flew into Milan, right? Malpensa?
Mm-hmm. Yep, good old Malpensa.
What struck you about the food? I mean, you did take a kind of tour of Italy, and one of the things you were there is to learn about gelato, right? Because you're thinking of starting a gelato movement here in Brooklyn, too.
It's true. We didn't, just to be clear, we didn't tour Italy. We were mostly in Piemonte, and okay. we took a short trip to Liguria. But interestingly enough, we went to Lanzarote to train with a gelato maker, an Italian guy from Genoa. And the whole trip was basically focused, or I should say, like, designed around this trip to Lanzarote to train with this guy. So we get there and we meet him, and he's a fantastic guy, just a really sweet, cool, fun guy to be around. And we do all the, you know, the introductions and some talking about stuff, and he establishes that, you know, we can work with food, and we establish that he works with food, and it's all cool. So we go to the lab, and it's a beautiful lab. He's got beautiful machines, and it's super sanitary and really nice to look at. And he's got, we go through the basics of the whole thing, and then he's like, okay, here's where the magic is. And he has this locked stainless steel giant cabinet built into the wall, and I don't
sounds
know
like
what
magic.
Really? I don't know what we expected
the
to see on the
Dr.
other side.
Dr. Caligari.
Of it. But there was definitely this moment of, like, you know, bated breath, and we were just all waiting. And he unlocks the cabinet, and opens it up, and it's just a giant cabinet full of powder and stabilizers and chemicals and, like, pre-mixes.
Oh, bummer, man.
And we were like, oh my god, we traveled halfway around the world for this. This is crazy.
Oh, Chris, that is heartbreaking.
That is so sad. You were like, no.
To jump to the good news, later on in the trip, we arranged to work with the pastry chef.
How long did you spend with that guy?
2 days.
Okay.
And he's a fantastic guy, yeah. and works really hard, and God bless him. But, like, he wasn't there. He wasn't going to show us what we were there to learn.
Right.
But we did talk a lot about gelato with him, and he knew a lot about gelato, and we talked about the history of gelato a lot and the current state of gelato, and we ate a lot of gelato while we were there. And we did eventually get to train with a pastry chef who worked under Paolo Soju, who okay. taught us to make the gelato that we wanted to learn how to make. So it all worked out fine in the end. But gelato is kind of in a sorry state in Europe, as far as I can tell.
Well, first of all, let's start with the definition of gelato, because I've never really understood why is gelato so specifically different from ice cream or
sorbet,
you know, I'm sure there are other people out there who share my ignorance. Let's hear what is gelato, and then the next question I have to follow up is, why did this guy need all these stabilizers and chemicals when it's really a
fresh
pretty straightforward
food,
product?
It is. Mass production is the answer to that. But so the definitions of all these things, this is my interpretation of them, because I feel like they're loose and a lot of people argue about what is what.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like gelato is made from milk. In the case of cream-based gelatos, stuff like fruit-based or stuff with acid flavors in it, they tend to make sorbets or sorbetos.
Mm-hmm.
They call it all gelato. It's a frozen dessert.
Right.
To them, that's all gelato. So anything with fruit in it is generally made with just water.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And things like, you know, hazelnut, pistachio, the big standards, those are all made with milk. American ice cream, as I understand it, originally... Oh, and eggs. I should include that gelato has eggs in it. American ice cream, as I understand it, originally... is made with cream and
eggs. You make a custard
and eggs, but you make the difference, I think, is cream in America and
milk
in Italy.
I see.
And that's a good enough definition for me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And what else did we want to talk about?
We wanted to talk about the mass production of gelato and why it's necessary
why
to include
that?
A lot of chemicals.
Right. Well, the first day we met with this guy, I said to him, he's like, what do you guys want to do? And I was like, well, I wouldn't mind hand churning the stuff, but I want to go back to the basics and make it as simply as we can from the rawest, best ingredients that we can find. And he laughed and he told me that I was crazy, that if I wanted to do that, I should do it at home. But that if I wanted to start a business and make some money, that I should forget all that nonsense and I should get down with the program that he was on, which was...
a big stainless steel fridge.
A cabinet.
Yeah. You need to be able to make large quantities very quickly and be able to hold them over several days.
Well, but that's true.
Right. Well,
well
it's... How many
batches do you want to make a day? I mean, you do have to balance that labor cost versus the,
you,
right?
You do.
Isn't that the whole trick in restaurant cooking in general?
It is. But I think that if what we're going to try and do is basically keep it fresh, produce for the day, mm-hmm. every day. And when we run out, we run out. And then shift production as we need to either climb or to upscale or downscale.
Right.
And when I told him that we wanted to do that, he's like, yeah. I mean, I explained to him what we want to do. And he's like, you know, you can do that. You can definitely do that. But he's like, you're going to create a lot more work for yourself and you're not going to make as much money. And I was like, well, that seems like a decent trade-off for a good product. But I don't see any other way around that. But he basically, all these stabilizers, chemicals, premixes, all the stuff that I would estimate 90 to 95% of the gelato industry in Europe is using now, all are the result of massive, demand for gelato. He told me, it's funny, he has a little spot on the beach in Lanzarote in Playa Blanca, and high traffic area, lots of European tourists. And he told me that Italians eat, on average, 10 kilos of gelato a year. And
shazam.
It's 20
That's
pounds.
That's 22 pounds.
22,
Whoa.
Right.
Get
22.
Ready for this. He's like, if I had it my way, I would not be here on the beach. I would be in Germany making gelato in Germany, because Germans, on average, eat 55 kilos of gelato a year. And they eat it. They eat it 12 months out of the year.
Oh, so it's not just a summer treat for them.
No. It's a major part of their diet.
That is awesome.
And which I thought was fascinating. So when you start to put those numbers together, and then you factor in, the want of not working so hard, it starts to get really easy to see why these guys use all these stabilizers and premixes, because they can mm-hmm. produce more for less.
Well, and also, but they have to transport it, because if they're doing it in large quantities, they're selling it through more than one outlet.
Yeah, if you become a wholesaler.
Presumably. You know. Although
a lot of them are just specific to that locale, to that one storefront or whatever.
Yeah, more often than that, they produce on site. But they're still holding the product for longer than I think is right for the freshness and quality.
And also it presumes them. It's a nice confidence to have as a businessman where you're like, we're going to sell out every day. So what does this mean for people in Brooklyn? I mean, are we, is it going to be at the end of this summer? Or, I mean, what are your plans for what you've learned here?
We're in the middle of figuring it all out right now. We're burning the midnight oil. And I think we're going to try and get open by July 1st, and I think we can do it. Mm-hmm. We're going to be on North 6th, a couple doors in from the Bedford intersection in the
alley.
Which
already serves bread, right?
This is going to be like a cart or a storefront? Or
a cart. We're going to do it outside in an alley. And we're going to produce here at the restaurant in the morning and then lug it down there and sell it till we sell out daily.
Awesome. So. Like you do the bread. Does that still happen with the bread?
Yeah, every Saturday. From noon till 6, we're
fresh bread, fresh gelato.
Oh, I love that. That's wonderful, Chris.
Thanks. That is awesome.
Yeah, I'm into it. I mean, the more we can use this space to produce and then get it out on the street and sell it as directly as possible to the consumer, I think that's our vibe for the mm-hmm. next year. So,
well, I didn't thank you on air, but congratulate you on air, but I mean, congratulations on your review and on a busy day yesterday.
Thanks, man. Like
you're finally getting the due that anyone who's ever eaten here knew was so well deserved. Now more people know about it.
Thanks.
And we'll all do our best to keep the tom-toms beating.
Thank you.
Awesome. All right.
Congratulations to you guys.
This has been a great show. We had Shauna Pacifico. We had
Alice Waters. And Chris Parrachini.
So, Katie, we'll see you next week. You'll be here next week, right?
Yes, Patrick.
I'm always fearful that you're going to be like, I'm done with this.
I will be here
this.
Next week no matter what.
I only have questions for 30 minutes, not an hour. Awesome. All right. Well, we'll be back next week with the main course, and stay tuned for the Q report about art. All right. Thanks, dude.
Yeah, man.
Chris, perfect. That was awesome.